Session number 926, Alan Carter, Reel 1.
Where did you join the army, Mr. Carter?
I went to Middlesbrough on the 5th of the 1st, 1933. And I really went to see somebody I knew in Middlesbrough. It was a girl that used to work on a farm with me. She lived down in Cannon Street, and I didn't know then that it was a notorious area, because these lads who I eventually met in the army then were Middlesbrough lads, and I mentioned Cannon Street and they were telling me all about it. Anyway, I found her and had a talk with her and said, well, I'm going to join the army, going to the recruiting office, and I'll most likely see you tonight. But if you don't see, if I don't, they've kept me too long, I'll have to catch the bus to Richmond. They kept me quite a long time in the recruiting office, and there was lots of lads there, and we kept asking each other, which regiment are you going to join, and certain regiments. The biggest pull was the corps, such as engineers, signals and cavalry, because their terms of service was 6 years with the colours and 6 years on the reserve, while the infantry was 7 and 5 years. Plus, if you went to India, which was notorious for keeping you another year, which meant 8 years with the colours and 4 with the reserve. That was on account of trooping, and being so many troops out in India, as you know, India was the biggest garrison of the lot. And their excuse was they couldn't get us all home, you see. So if you missed that season, the season, you went for another year. So we always said, like, among ourselves, well, that's a bookshe year for the Queen, king at the time it was. And we, as we said, we tried to get in the corps, such as engineers and that and the other, but they put us off by saying they were full up, like. It was infantry they wanted, and they gave us so many infantry regiments. And I finally chose the Green Howards because a lad I knew was a schoolmate of mine, he was in there, so I ended up at Richmond, and I went up the Barrack Hill, which I don't know, you know, is a big hill, and into the guard room. And at the night time, I went into a room of my own, which they call a reception room, and you were in there for the night. However, I kept getting a visit from a certain soldier, big smart lad he was. He kept coming in with different equipment on, such as marching order and this and the other. And towards the night, when the first post had gone, he happened to be in, and a big tall corporal came in and ordered him out. And I learnt then that he was on defaulters. And little to my knowledge, it was many years after I was to meet him again, because although he stopped with the 1st Battalion, he became a battalion boxer, and I went to the 2nd Battalion. When I came home in 1944, we had a big exercise on for the invasion, which was included all the 50 divisional NCOs, which I was one, like, and they were demonstrating the Crocodile. That was the tank that belched these fire out of its firefighter, not a firefighter, flamethrower. They called it the Crocodile. Plus the tank that swam underwater. Although we hadn't noticed it, the officer did say to us, he said, did you notice that tank as you came up? We said, no. He says, well, he says, there's something unusual about it. And that was the inflated tank that was to take part in the division. At any rate, we were all gathered round listened to this here demonstration, and I noticed a sergeant of the Hampshire's speak to one of our sergeants. He evidently knew him, and this sergeant of ours pointed to me. So he came over to me. He said, "You come from the 2nd Battalion, haven't you?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Do you know our lad?" I said, "What's his name?" He says, "Callaghan." "Oh, yes, I know him." And this was the same fella who was on defaulters when I first joined up the first day. He'd been transferred to the Hampshire's and he was a sergeant. And the lad he was on about, his brother, was still in the 2nd Battalion. I ran into him just after the war in Europe was over. We met on the train. I said, "I met your lad in the Hampshire's." I said, "How is he?" "Oh," he said, "he was killed on D-Day." Is it going all right, or do you want to retrace it?
It's going fine.
Ah.
So, what happened when you got to Richmond? What were the first things they showed you?
Oh, well, I would say initial training for a recruit is the same as learning to swim. It's the most exciting thing there is. You're learning all the time, and I think it was part of the happiest days I ever had. However, I was unlucky. About 3 or 4 days after I got to Richmond, I went down with pneumonia. At the time, I didn't know it. I reported sick, and they put me in a room what they had at Richmond. And then one day, one of the medical orderlies said, "Well, we're sending you to hospital for a few days, like." So the ambulance came, and I remember being on the stretcher and putting the ambulance and going across the square. I remember getting to Catterick Hospital, being at the ward end. I went in at the end of the ward, and I was at the farthest bed away from where the sisters' quarters is at the top. I remember going in there. Then I remember no more till I woke up and I was at the other end of the ward, and my mother was sat beside me. I said to her, "How long have I been here?" She said, "A fortnight." I said, "No, only a week." And I'd lost a week of my life. And the MO who treated us, there was a lot of men down with pneumonia there, a few died. I was to meet him at Meerut a few years after. And at any rate, after 3 months, I had a month's leave, sick leave, and I went back to training again.
What were conditions like in the hospital? Did you have any duties to do while you were there?
Well, funnily enough, the duties were pretty rough. For instance, I was still not on the DI list, I was still on the seriously ill list, but the orderly would come and plant all the wards, nice forks and spoons for me to clean, even though I was laid in bed. And then you were supposed to bump the floor and help the orderlies. Maybe it was a good thing, I didn't realise how ill I was like, so I never worried. Maybe that helped me to recover, but they certainly were very Spartan in the hospitals. And if the orderlies could get away with putting anything onto the patients to do, do it. I think it's true about the RAMC, Rob, all my comrades, they were always after a sub and conning you. However, I was, when I did really begin to turn and get better, I was put on a tonic, and I can remember it must have been a real good tonic, because I asked for 2 dinners one day and I ate them up. And it's marvellous how you recover from pneumonia so quick. However, it did leave me with one thing, and I thought I might get my ticket on this. And that was, I'd fallen arches, we'd been in bed so long. And I thought, most likely, we'd been in the infantry, they'd discharge me. However, I marched all over India and most of France and part of Germany and didn't trouble me. But when I was discharged from the army and I applied for a postman's job, it troubled them. I went for my medical examination to be a postman. And he looked at my feet and there was a query. It lasted about 6 weeks before I thought, well, they're going to reject me. However, they took me on, but I thought, isn't it good? Like, I've done an infantryman for about 13 years and I can't do a postman's job. But the doctor passed me eventually. He said, we had a bit of trouble with your flat feet, he said, but they must have rung the army up and got me record and everything like, so I became a postman. The training at Richmond was real good, like. It was marvellous. Most of the lads there had been unemployed miners, Durham miners, and all such as that, like, were a real good crowd. And I remember one Geordie, he was a Geordie miner, a thick-set little miner he was. We'd gotten into trouble once. We'd been playing football in the barrack room and smashed some pitchers and, of course, one split on us and brought the officer up and he gave us a rollicking leg. However, I slept nearest the door and the culprit slept right at the other end of the barrack room, next to the lance corporal in charge of the barracks, you see. Now, this here, I've never thought it would happen, like. This here, they called him Tug Wilson. Just before lights out, he came in with a bucket of water. And he looked at me, and I was in bed, and I looked at him. And he put in a bucket of water just outside of my bed. And I looked at him, and I thought, now, and what's going to happen now, like? At any rate, lights went out and I was laying in bed and I was straining. And it's a hard thing to lift a bucket of water and not make a creak or anything. And I was straining, listening. I thought, well, he's chickened out. He's not going to do it. And all of a sudden there was a big clatter and a splash of water. And then the lance corporal came up. The light switch was against me, switch on the light. The water had gone all over him. It had gone over this bloke who'd split on him. And in come the sergeant. Of course, the water went down on the lads below, straight through the floor. He admitted he'd done it, this Tug Wilson. He admitted he'd done it, and he went straight in the guard room, and he got a few days CB. He was quite happy about it. But it was comical. I could never have lifted a bucket of water and not made a creak, but he did. And another thing he did, he made us laugh. We were being instructed, when an officer approaches you, you come to attention and you say, sir. Now, Tug couldn't do this. As he was coming to attention, he was saying, sir. So the sergeant kept at him a few times, like, and in the finish, Tug got that real riled up. He took his hat off and he slung it on the parade ground and he said, sergeant, I cannot do it. So the sergeant had no option but to call a certain one out of the ranks to act as escort, and the guard room was at the other end of the parade. The policeman always watching out, he saw what had happened. So he fell in behind the escort, and away went the escort, double. And of course, he was a real greyhound, was the escort. He was built like a greyhound, a big long nose and a big long chin. And away he went. Well, Tug just sauntered on. He wouldn't double, he just walked on. Well, the escort was out of sight. However, we were very anxious the next day to see what Tug had got, punishment. And we'd just finished PT and we went into change. And the orderly room had been about 9 o'clock, so Tug was in the barrack room when we got in, like. And we were all anxious to find out what he'd got, like sentence and that and the other. And all of a sudden he burst out laughing. And he pointed at his escort. And he says, "Do you know," he said. He said, "When I got to the guard room," he said, "they had him locked up in cell." He said, "You see, the policeman saw what had happened. He'd had the cell door open. This bloke had galloped away, and he'd galloped straight into the cell, and he slammed the door on him." And that was it. We all burst out laughing then, like, it. He was real good. Real good company and that and the other, and I enjoyed my time at the depot.
How long had you been in the army before you got news of your posting to India?
Well, we knew there was always a draft at the back end. Trooping time started in September and went through till about the March. So I joined the battalion about August, but they generally let you have about a year with the 1st Battalion, and then, because the draft would already be made up for that year, then you were on the next one. You could expect to go on the next one. And the names were all published. I think we were in camp at Warminster when we got news of we were on the draft. We were all inoculated there at two jobs we were given. That was the start, and then we were sent on embarkation leave, and in the October we knew we'd be sailing.
What did you feel when you knew you'd been sent to India rather than anywhere else? Was it a popular posting?
Well, India's not a popular posting. As I say, there was that drawback of you could look forward for a bush a year for the Queen, or the King at the time, like, on account of there wasn't enough troop ships and that to bring the time-expired men back. Plus the fact that I think the old doolally tap such as that used to enter the conversation, like, "You'll get doolally tap" and all this and to which was ridiculous, because there was, if you looked after yourself, there was no risk of getting that, although I did see one go down with sunstroke and fade straight out, like, but there was no need to if you'd known the right way. In fact, the salt tablets was the answer to it.
Did you speak to any old soldiers who'd been to India, or were you told anything about it?
Oh, yes, there was always the old soldiers on about India, and always the old tales about certain things, like, you know. But we had going with us two members of the battalion from India who'd been on 6 months' leave. Now, they qualified for that. There were band boys. There'd been band boys. One was a drummer and one was in the band. And they'd done after 6 years, you could claim 6 month holiday, you know, posting back to England, provided, now this was a catch, provided you signed on for another 6 years. Anyway, these two did join us at Portland. They were escorting us back. They'd had the leave. And of course, we quizzed them all the way on the troop ship, like, what things like. But to look at them, that they were a good advert, because they were real big, bronze-smashing fellas, like. I thought, well, he's done them no harm, you see, which gave us away. And all we could get out of them, mostly, was, well, what do you do? And it was always, well, at night time it's all sport, and a few parades in the morning, and, you know, and we quizzed them all the way, and but they were, to look at them, it was enough for us. We saw they were big, fine fellas, and it hadn't done them any harm, so it gave us confidence.
And were you given any official information about India? Did the officers tell you anything about it?
No, there was no information at all. It was a subject that was always going among the ranks, like, because you always had members of the second battalion who had been in India who'd come back and that and the other. You learned it as you went along, like. Actually, you couldn't learn what the heat was like, conditions and that, but I would say not very much information. I think information they could have given you was, try and learn Hindustani, which would have been a big help. Because I think you did qualify for extra money if you passed out in Hindustani. And I've always thought, a pity I didn't, like, because you could have mixed with them and got their side of the life as well. Plus the fact, when the war came, like, you'd have been with the Indian regiment, maybe as an officer or something like that, you see, if you'd learned Hindustani and something like that. But you let things slide when they're young. But that's one thing I regret, maybe.
What was the voyage like?
The voyage was very good. The Bay of Biscay, they're always reckoned you got seasick or something like that, but we got through that very nicely. And I'm not a good sailor, but I wasn't seasick. And when you got into the Mediterranean, well, it was very nice indeed, calm as could be. And through the Suez was quite an eye-opener. We stopped there a bit, like, and watching these here diving in for coins and all the things they brought up for you to buy, all that and the other. Throw a few pennies in and they dive down into the sea for it. And then we went up the Persian Gulf and to drop some RAF details out. Some of the lads left the ship there that could swim, because they had a real good swimming pool, I understand, but I couldn't swim at that time. And I did learn to swim eventually when I got to India, because it was most essential then, like, with it being so hot. And I taught myself. In fact, I used to go to the baths when they were all at meal, you see. I didn't want to be in with them, the rest of them. I was a bit... Well, so I used to gollop my meal down, and then I'd go to the baths. It was empty, and I finally plucked up courage, and I thought to myself, no, if I go to the bottom of the bath and I come up again, I'm all right. So I went down to the bottom of the bath, I plunged down, and I found out I could stay down there and come up, and that gave me confidence. And then I hung on to the rails a bit and splashed a bit, and I was swimming then. But swimming's only a matter of, I think, your fear of going down and not coming up again. And once you've overcome that, find that all you do is put your hands out and you come up, you're away. But some never could get to swim. I know we were swimming in a dirty old canal when we were on manoeuvres once, and I thought this lad was doing very well. He was going through all the motions, but his feet were on the bottom. I couldn't get him to swim. Yes. As I say, from there we landed at Karachi, and there was a troop train waiting for us. Six men to a compartment, which split into beds, six beds, like racks to pull down on hinges. And about 5 days' journey, and we were in Meerut. But it must have been laid out certain places. The grub was, I suppose, a certain unit was detailed for a stop and to provide us with meals, and then we went on.
Was it... On the ship and on the train, was much attention paid to the troops' comfort at all?
Well, as far as could be, there was concerts. I can remember one concert, one song that was sung there. It was very popular at the time, and it was "Little Man, You've Had a Busy Day," and this lad used to sing that in concerts. And then they used to get boxing matches up, and otherwise, it was quite enjoyable.
Did you have enough room, or was there Were there a lot of troops on the ship?
Oh, there was quite a lot of troops, but I wouldn't say we were that badly off, right? Some slept in hammocks, and some slept on the floor if they didn't fancy putting the hammocks up, but it was detailed to carry a certain amount of troops, and this is what it did like. It was under the regulations. I mean, I don't suppose they could crowd you that much because the regulations were there, how many troops that troops it could carry.
And what were your first impressions of Karachi?
Well, first impressions of Karachi, like, it was very hot, although it was only November. I didn't realise then, like, that after I'd been climatised, this was the cold weather, you see. But the poverty and that, you know, and all the beggars on the railway station and that wasn't very impressive. We were also not allowed to buy anything off them, you see, such as fruit or anything that was there. Because of the dysentery, it wasn't... There was plenty of fruit and that they had, but we weren't allowed to touch it. And otherwise, I wasn't very my first impression of India was, I would say, of very disappointing. I didn't like it at all. And I wasn't to like it for a year or so till I got acclimatised, and then things seemed to improve. It didn't matter then. So we carried on, and at that time things were really strict. Training and discipline and all a lot in the army at that time. It was like going into a different world than leaving England, where you just got used to your mates here, and then going to another lot of new lads there. And we were treated a bit like juveniles, like we were marched here, and in fact it was like a new set of drill. I mean, the 1st Battalion had a different time in arms drill. It was a little slower to what was adopted with the 2nd, and we had to get used to that. And for about 6 months, it was outside the draft, the UK draft. It was, you know, the new draft, and we would extra drills and listen to them before we were qualified, like to do guard duties or join the battalion. We were more or less lepers for, you know, and we had to be smartened up, and then things began to alter then.